We can open a full committee on the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs.
Madam Chair, I move.
You're out of order.
Sorry.
Okay. What I first would like to do is I'm very honored to have the committee members on my that have been given to me, and I think it's going to be a very fun and a very productive committee. But I would like to have those committee members that are here introduce themselves, tell them where they're from.
I'm Senator Peter Courtney, Senate District 11, which is portions of Salem, all of Jervis, and Woodburn.
I'm Margaret Carter, Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland, near Lloyd Center, down by the Convention Center, out near the airport.
And I'd like the committee staff, Shannon.
My name is Shannon Strumpfer, from Portland, a master's student at Portland State University in public administration.
And we have Josh Bishop, who is going to be, what is he called?
I'm a committee assistant from Oregon State University.
Okay, he's from Oregon State University, and he's a committee assistant. And they're both new to the session this time, and I'm very pleased to be working with them. It's been fun already working with them. All right.
Who are you, please?
I am a Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and a nurse by trade, and I represent Senate District 25, which is Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I'm very happy to be here. Any other comments?
Yes, from the Madam Chair.
Senator
I want to
Carter.
Tell you how much I enjoyed being on your committee, and what a good chair I think you are, because we did a lot of work during the interim, and I'm looking forward to being on this committee.
Well, what
Thank
is that?
You.
That is suck up, you know.
All righty. With that, I would like to like you to take a look at the committee rules.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move that the Health Policy Public Affairs Committee adopt Senate Model Rule Committee Rules 2007 session.
All right. Senator Courtney has moved that we adopt the Senate Model Committee Rules 2007 session. Is there any discussion? And is there any opposition? So ordered. Oh, good. Before we go to the next piece, we're going to have Senator Cruz introduce himself, tell us where he's from, and if he wants to be on this committee or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. I was in a meeting with some folks in the governor's staff, and we ran over just a bit. So. Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Hi, Bob. Which is Douglas, Coos, Curry, Jackson, and Josephine counties. And served with the chair several times, and very much looking forward to the work we're going to do.
Great. Thank you. All right.
Just one more thing.
Yes.
I am really disappointed in Senator Courtney. He puts on the public record that I was a sucker. And then the senator from Roseburg does the same thing, and he says nothing. I'm offended.
Well, he's late, too. He's late as well as being a sucker.
I'm a late suck-up? Is that pretty much it? Okay.
Okay. I'm not sure it's a good idea to have you two sitting next to each other. And I thought I had arranged it differently, but these are how they were up. They're supposed to be switched. I wanted Carter to be here and Abel to be there so they could be on either side of the committee when I have to leave. Okay?
She is the chair.
That's right. But he's a mess. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Okay. All righty. I would like to... mental health is an extremely important issue to me, and I think to every member on this committee.
Yes.
And we are going to be dealing with some very important issues, and We do have a master plan for the Oregon State Hospital and mental health reform. And this first committee, since we do really want to accomplish things, I wanted the first meeting to be a summation of where we are at with the Oregon State Hospital master plan and the reform, an update on the mental health and addiction services, because we do want to make progress and be productive. So I would like to ask Bob Nickel up, the Assistant Director of Addictions and Mental Health, who will give us just a brief overview of where we are on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel. I'm Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services under Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and my area of responsibility is the Addictions and Mental Health Division. Since we last appeared here, we've changed some names again within the department. We haven't reorganized, but we do have new titles. So we're the Addictions and Mental Health Division, and I have responsibility for all of the mental health services, including community mental health, state hospital, addictions programs in the community, including gambling addiction and prevention services. It's a broad area of responsibility, obviously. A lot of what we do will revolve this session around the state hospital and community master plan. So I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee for starting off with some information today and discussion about where we're at. I hope to answer as many questions today, but knowing that there are a lot of complexities here, it will probably take some more time to get all of the information to you that you want to have, and we'll do our best to give that to you. I've prepared talking points, and I have the outline over with Mr. Bishop. Maybe you've all received it already, and so I'm going to propose to walk through it as quickly as we can, hopefully allow a little bit of time for questions, and of course, as is your practice, feel free to interrupt me and ask questions as I go along too. So I think we wanted to give you a quick overview of the state hospital and the community service system. Together is really what we're talking about, and I want to make sure that we acknowledge the work that Senator Courtney has done and has called our attention to the fact that we can't just plan for a state hospital. It's really a state hospital community system. So
can everything you pull, can you pull the mic directly in front of you? Thank you.
So Oregon State Hospital and the community system together provide services and supports, and I'm using services and supports deliberately because not everything that we do or need to do for people involve just providing them treatment services. There are a variety of supports that people need in order to live successfully in community settings. So a good example of that would be housing. Another example would be peer supports, and there are many others that we'll talk about. So we really have a system of both treatment and supports that go to help people in our state who have a variety of serious mental health problems and often addiction problems as well. The state hospital is really the tip of an iceberg. We serve 434 forensic patients at the Salem campus, 65 civil commitments, and 114 geropsychiatric, or as we may be calling these units in the future, neuroscience programs, because there are more and more people with various kinds of head injuries. And as we learn more about the process of aging, we know that a normal process of aging does not lead toward dementias and other kinds of neurological problems that we actually see in many of our older patients. We also, as you probably know, have a capacity of 68 beds at the Portland campus, which is part of Oregon State Hospital. Today we have 54 patients in those beds. We've temporarily downsized in order to accommodate the construction that's going on there, and we're on schedule to meet the schedule for opening another 24 beds there, but temporarily we've had to go down just a little bit in order to accommodate the construction issues. We also have 60 beds in Eastern Oregon. So our total is roughly about 730 patients at any given time. By comparison, I just wanted to put in the notes here that we served 71,000
820 people in the adult public mental health system in fiscal year 2005-2006, and an additional 37,467 kids during that period of time. So when I say the tip of an iceberg, it really is that we serve a very small minority of people in our state hospitals. And yet it's about roughly 25% of our budget. State hospitals, as we've talked about many times with members of the committee, is a very expensive way to treat people, and only the people who are most vulnerable and most severely in need, and almost all court-committed, either criminally or civilly committed, that's who we serve in our state hospital system.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Bob, do you have an... I had a conversation with Max Williams the other day. Do you have a good number of the folks in corrections that their main issue is mental health?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, we have pretty good estimates. There was a national study that was recently done, and the number that came out of that was about 20% of inmates nationally and in Oregon are believed to have some serious mental health problem. Now, that 20%, if you look more carefully at the details, is not all people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which is mostly what we serve in the state hospital. But even there are a lot of people with those very serious mental illnesses who are served in our Department of Corrections.
Yeah, follow up. I think as we're looking at this, those that do have similar characteristics to those in our forensic unit, I mean, we may need to be looking at a transition program for them to more appropriate services. So, and I know that's been discussed. So.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I'd also like to put on the record that we did a study of jail managers, which is the county local jail situation, and about 196,000 admissions per year to those facilities all over the state, and about a little over 9% of those people have fairly serious mental health issues, and even larger number have other kinds of mental health problems. So in the jail system, obviously we're dealing with a very large number of people who also have that, and I think as we think about the system, we have to include those people in our thinking as well. All right, again, the department's approach to the master plan is to consider the mental health system as a whole, not separate parts, because most patients return to their communities, and the health of the community mental health system has a lot to do with the health of the state hospital system, and vice versa. So these are, you know, in clinical terms, these are symbiotic relationships. They depend on each other. We really can't think about one without the other. So again, going back to information that I know a lot of all of the members of the committee are already aware of, but just for the record, we're using old, architecturally outdated facilities, primarily in Salem and to some degree in Eastern Oregon. There are still patients in what we call the J building, or at least in parts of the J building. It was started in 1883. And as we go through this process together in this legislative session, I often remind people in the department, we get this chance apparently about once every 123 years. So we need to do this right, and we need to do it well, and that's our commitment in the department to do this. Even though we don't have a lot of precedents for how to do this, we're going to work very hard to take each of the steps that we need to take. As you all know, there are many deferred maintenance problems, particularly at the Salem campus. The elevator breaks down from time to time. That can become an Americans with Disability Act issue if we don't keep all of the elevators working. We have a couple of them, but one has a leak, and I can't go into all of the technical detail about that, but that's just one example of the kind of basic issues that we have in the Salem campus that we need to deal with. Senator Courtney has walked through the facility with me and with others and has seen the very worst parts of the buildings, which we no longer have for patient care, but they're truly abysmal in their conditions, and obviously, we don't, and we would never put patients there, but that's the long-term effect of really not taking care of a lot of maintenance issues in the state hospital over time. The governor.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Would you rather, first let you finish, and then we ask so you can have a cohesive report. What is your preference?
Excuse me.
What would be your preference? Would you rather first let you complete your oversight and then we ask questions so you can have a completed thought?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'm comfortable with answering questions as I go along.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm glad that the President is on this committee, because as I look at the Governor's strategy and in terms of the approach to the master plan, I'm gravely concerned I'm gravely concerned because when you talk about mental health as a system being hospital and community services, I don't see the dollar commitment there that would allow us to be as holistic as we're presenting on paper. And that's number one. Number two, I worry about the approach to flat funding in terms of depending so much on tobacco tax to help pay for some of these services, Mr. President. And as we look at diminishing returns in terms of how effective we're being in Oregon as bringing more people off smoking, the dollars are dwindling. And so I worry about sustainability. In any insight you can give us on that, or would you just rather for us to wait and talk to the leadership on that issue, or what are your thoughts? Do you think $36.5 million is enough to do the kind of aggressive action that we have on paper?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, of course, you're putting me in a fairly awkward position to
perish the
make
thought.
Let me help you out. Let me help you out first. We had a meeting yesterday. We talked about this very, very same issue. And we charged the committee. What's the title of the committee? Community Health Services Committee?
It's the Community Services Work Group.
Work Group. And we were saying, we legislators, Representative Jensen and I were there, we, as a legislator, want to know what the true cost, just like QEM for education, true cost of mental health. We know we cannot possibly have all of the money to address that, but we want to know the true cost and then be strategic regarding what we can afford.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I do want to say that I know that the governor's commitment to this issue is real. He worked
yes.
within the constraints of the budget that he was preparing to balance it, and I think we all understand that this is part of a dialogue we'll have this session.
Right.
I think it is a good start.
It is.
I think that there are things in the governor's recommended budget that we have wanted for a long time, and I'll use one example very quickly, and that's the $4.4 million that's there to expand the early assessment and support teams, the EAST project that's been developed in the Mid-Willamette Valley area, which takes families, young people who are having their first psychotic episode, and provides them with really definitive, caring wraparound services. And it's making a huge difference in the lives of young people in this community over the last 5 years. And to have $4.4 million to expand that and create many more of these programs is a very strong step in the right direction. And I think we'll all have this discussion about, is this the right amount, and where should we direct these dollars early in the process of the state hospital master plan process. I think those are all very good discussions that we'll have. But I want to emphasize my sincere belief that the governor wants to move forward with this, and in his budget has begun to put some things in there that I think we can have a good chance to begin changing and as you've talked about, transforming the mental health system.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Mine is absolutely not, Bob, a criticism of the governor's budget, nor you. I think we have a golden opportunity here. And, Mr. President, I think that since we are using so many COPs in the system to take care of strategic planning projects that we have on the record, let's not half-step. Let's, if we have to take, Madam Chair, just a portion of the mental health system and do it well and show how effective we can be at it, and use the money for it, I'm there. I believe that with all sincereness, even when the governor first came in 5 years ago now, he put, at my request, we put a committee of people together to talk about this. So I know he's very sincere, but if we're going to be aggressive and if we're going to be bold, let's be successful even if we take a portion of what we have here, Mr. President, and your work, that I'd like to see that happen rather than to look at a total statewide strategy. And in 2 years, we have to reduce some of the services that we provide because we didn't anticipate the sustainable cost that it's going to take for that, especially when you look at flat funding.
Um, Madam Chair, I'll continue on. The section that I was just talking about was the governor's commitment. The department, Dr. Goldberg in particular, has been very supportive of moving forward with these issues. He and I have spent a great deal of time beginning to lay the groundwork for what we need to do now in order to prepare for a new state hospital building, hopefully in 4 to 5 years. I mean, we all understand that even if we pounded stakes in the ground today, it would be 4 years at least before we would open the new state hospital. So we have a period of time here where I believe we can prepare for that, and we're doing everything we can, and I'll talk a little bit more later about some of the initiatives that we have. There's always a bright side to lawsuits, and we did have 2 lawsuits over the last couple of years. One was the Miranda B lawsuit, which involved civil committed patients. We were able to reach a settlement with the Oregon Advocacy Center, and I'm pleased to say that we met all of the requirements that were in that settlement agreement. We had a subsequent lawsuit that involved forensic patients. That's the Harmon versus Fickle lawsuit. We also reached a settlement agreement, and we're in the process of working on that one. We had 2 main strategies, which the emergency board helped us with a great deal by approving 30 new professional-level positions at Oregon State Hospital, which helped us bring up the staffing. And then we're also continuing to develop and accelerate some of our community projects so that we discharge patients. So a combination of lowering the census at the state hospital and forensics and increasing the staffing is the main strategy that's built into the settlement agreement. We're working hard on that. We're a little behind on the actual numbers that we had targeted for community placements, but if we are successful in implementing all of the programs that we have online and we can open them all by the end of this biennium, I think we're going to come very close to, if not actually achieve, the target numbers for the community placements. And that's always a stretch to get all of the community projects opened on the schedule that we had hoped for. But we think we're in good shape, and we feel that we have done everything that we could in good faith to meet all of the terms of the settlement agreement. But that has moved us further ahead than we would have been, frankly, possibly, if we hadn't had those. You're aware, as a committee, I'm sure, that the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Person Act, CRIPA for short, has led to a federal review. We met with them in November. We invited them in. We're cooperating with them. We expect to have their report in March or April. In the meantime, we're not sitting around waiting for the report. We learned a number of the concerns that they had informally as they debriefed with us after their November visit, and so we are developing a plan for improvement of patient care. We have 2 of the top national experts as consultants helping us with this. I didn't put this in the notes, but Dr. Jeffrey Geller from the University of Massachusetts and Dr. Chris McLaughlin, who is a PhD nurse, who is from Hawaii and has been involved with the federal government there in overseeing Hawaii State Hospital. Those are 2 of the top nationally recognized consultants. We were able to nab them just as quickly as we realized that we needed to have consultants, and so they're working with us. They'll be back here in the next couple of weeks, and they'll continue to work with us on the plan. We also have hired Dr. Joseph Bloom, former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Sciences University, to help us with that and some other issues. And we have just, I think I speak to this a little bit later, we've also hired Dr. John Bischoff as our chief psychiatrist on a contract with Oregon Health and Sciences University. He's also helping us develop the response to the CRIPA review. We have been developing since 1994, anticipating the closure of Damage State Hospital 10, 11 years ago, a whole system of care out there that people don't always realize is out there, but we now have over 1,200 placements. Many of them are in 24-hour residential care, but some of them are intensive case management services. But the point is, we have been developing intensive high-level community services that we didn't have 15 years ago in this state, which also puts us in a position to prepare for the state hospital and community master plan. We'll continue to develop about 100 new placements each year, which is normally funded and I expect would be funded in our base budget due to a factor called caseload growth. And I won't belabor all of this, but we were successful a couple of biennia ago in getting into our base budget services that we knew we were going to have to provide to court-committed In other words, forensically and civilly committed patients who, once they're committed, are going to be with us for a while. And so we have built a factor into our budget to take care of that. The governor's mental health task force recommendations issued in September of 2004 also began to set the stage for what we're doing. It promoted a system of care for adults as well as children. We've tended to think about that concept more in the children's area, but it's just as useful a concept in adults. That report noted that the system is underfunded and that inadequate planning has led to overcrowding, wait lists for people to get into the state hospital, overuse of the criminal justice system, as we talked about a few minutes ago, and the state hospital, including our forensics units. Oregon has been a national leader also in implementing Senate Bill 267, which was the evidence-based practice bill that came out of the Judiciary Committees in 2003. The mental health and addiction system have worked very hard during that time. I restructured my office in part to make sure that we dealt with that issue, and I'm pleased to say that we're ahead of schedule in terms of meeting the statutorily required percentages of funding. The challenge there now is to sustain those things, to continue to increase them, and to make sure that we don't just say we have evidence-based practices, but that we have fidelity scales that we can use to make sure that programs actually are implementing those. A concern that I think we should continue to talk about, and we talked about it yesterday at the Community Services Work Group with Senator Manas Anderson, is the question whether we have adequate resources to sustain those kind of evidence-based practices. It's not necessarily that they cost more, but they do require some costs to ramp up to get programs operating consistently with the kind of standards that you would expect in evidence-based practices. And the supervision costs are really critical there, because one of the things that you have to sustain evidence-based practices or any new practice is enough supervision of the process at the local level to make sure that new workers get on board and continue to provide these services according to the standards. I've mentioned already that we've hired Dr. John Bischoff and Dr. Joe Bloom. We also have not hired any doctors under this contract yet, but we do have a contract now signed about 6 weeks ago to add up to 6 Oregon Health Science University psychiatrists to the treatment teams at Oregon State Hospital. As you know, we've had a hard time hiring psychiatrists, and at any given time we have 12 to 16 psychiatrist vacancies in the state hospital. We are not about union busting here, and we are going to continue to aggressively hire, recruit, and retain our regular staff physicians. But it's time that we begin to have a closer relationship with Oregon Health and Sciences University, and we are able to hire up to 6 physicians under a contract. This has been a long-term goal of some of us, is to have a much closer, thank you, working relationship, and I'm pleased that we have this capability now. All right, now let me get into the master plan phase 1 and phase 2 reports. As you remember, the phase 1 report was largely a facility plant review. It told us things that we pretty much knew, but it put a much more pointed and detailed view of it. We have old, outdated buildings, architecturally not capable of providing the kind of state-of-the-art services that we want to provide in this state. And obviously there was a lot of concern about the seismic vulnerability of part of the J building. And we're working on plans to move patients out of the J building. That's part of what the Portland campus remodel is about, and we're also hoping that we can reduce the census by the end of this biennium enough that we can get all of those patients out of there. We will continue to update you on exactly where we're at with that. I will tell you that that is a challenge to get all of the patients out of the 41 building. It's about 100 patients, but if all goes according to plan, we have a very good shot at it by the end of the biennium. But I always have to preface that by saying, if everything goes according to plan. That's not as easy to pull off as sometimes it would appear. The phase 2 report, the governor and legislative leadership have recommended option 2, which, as you know, are to build 2 relatively large state hospitals, a 620-bed hospital located in the Salem-Portland area, a 360-bed hospital located south of Linn County, west of the Cascades, and north of California. We have, Senator Courtney, we have 10 sites in the southern Oregon area. We had 11 at one point, but the site in Grants Pass was pulled away by the owners. We still have 10 sites. We're actively reviewing them using the criteria that we developed with Dr. Goldberg and a committee of 8 legislators in the fall. So the Department of Administrative Services is taking the lead on the technical aspects. My office is taking the lead on the more programmatic aspects of the sites. We also have 6 sites in the Portland-Salem area. I can get you the details of that. I didn't bring that today, but I can get you the details of where exactly those sites are. I can tell you, because we just have some talking points that were just approved yesterday, 3 of the sites in the northern Willamette Valley area are in the Hillsboro area, and 3 are in the Salem area, including the site on Center Street of the current state hospital. And we're evaluating all of those sites using the criteria. I will tell you that the Salem site on Center Street is the most complex to evaluate, because there's already obviously buildings there, infrastructure, and it's on 2 sides of Center Street. So it's a complicated analysis, but we are doing it. We will evaluate that and provide just as good information on that site as we can on the others. In southwestern Oregon, I mentioned 10 proposed sites. 5 are in Jackson County, 2 are north of Springfield, and 1 is east of Roseburg. And 1 is in Coquille, and the final site is near Junction City. A couple of those are state-owned, but a number of them are private-owned. And again, we're in the process of looking in great detail about every one of those sites.
And is the community, I know, having had experience in my area, is sometimes the community says, not in my backyard. And have these sites been approved by the local jurisdictions?
Madam Chair, no, they've not been approved yet. That's part of what we're looking at, is what is the zoning now? What is the community's interest, receptivity? Is there significant opposition that we need to take care of? Those are some of the what we call program criteria that my office is taking the lead on evaluating. And we have a very clear criteria that came out of the site selection committee to use in evaluating those.
Okay. Are we going to have a timeline? You know, I get nervous about us. I truly want to be done by the end of June, as I think everyone in this building is wants. But regarding specific, what will we as a committee need to say A or nay to? I sort of would like to get an idea of what we will need to do to make sure that this plan goes forward. And if you could get a timeline to us as quickly as possible so that we can make sure that that fits into the committee schedule.
Madam Chair, we will do that. We do have a draft timeline already. I can tell you we are right on schedule. We promised the governor's office we'll have a draft report to him on the sites by mid-February, and we've publicly committed and will have a report from the executive level of government to the legislative branch on February 29th. So we are on schedule. I'm absolutely confident we'll make that. And then the idea, of course, is to allow enough time during this session so that there can be a full airing of issues and discussion, and so that the, obviously the legislature will have major decisions to make about which site and what direction we go in.
Great.
I've already mentioned some of the personnel that we've dedicated within the Department of Human Services. I also want to announce that we've hired Karen Bazo, who's retired but former director of the Oregon Youth Authority and a person with a lot of experience in state government and also working with the development of the OYA facilities that were developed. She joined us about 2 weeks ago. She will help me spearhead all of the activities related to the State Hospital Community Master Plan, and I'm really pleased that Karen has agreed to join us for the next 6 months, and you'll be seeing more of her around the legislature as this process unfolds. today she's helping cover a meeting in Portland that's talking with nurses about what is our nursing model for the state hospital. This is an example of the kind of things that we're looking at. We can't assume that whatever staffing model we have now, with the buildings that we have now with wards that are 35 and 40 patients, will look the same with wards that we think need to be much more reasonably sized, like around 20. So we have a meeting today that's looking at that. Tomorrow we have a meeting of nurses to look at the workforce development challenge that we have, because we anticipate that our staffing pattern will need to hire many more nurses over the next 5 to 10 to 15 years. And this is something that we need to begin working on now, because it's no secret that there's a national nursing shortage. The governor has worked very hard to increase the number of nursing slots in training programs in this state, but we also need to make sure that we target psychiatric nurses as part of that initiative. The Department of Administrative Services has hired Ed Wales to be their key project coordinator. Bob Reitmeier is also very involved. And we've just hired Sharon Anderson to work at Oregon State Hospital as the state hospital coordinator for our planning process. So I think we have many of the pieces in place now already, and I'm confident that we've hired very good people to help us move through the process. I wanted to mention 5 work groups that I initiated to prepare us for this. I just mentioned the Psychiatric Nurses Workforce Development Team, a very energetic group of people. We have people from the Oregon Center for Nursing, the Oregon Nursing Association, the Board of Nursing, and the nursing schools. They're very excited about the opportunity to begin to work on this project now before we get too much further along. We have an acute care policy leadership work group we've been meeting about on a monthly basis. Is another critical issue in the whole community hospital master planning process. As you all know, about 15 years ago, we moved toward a system where we do not admit people on acute psychiatric care needs to the state hospitals anymore. We have about 14 or 15 units in general hospitals scattered around the state. They're in varying stages of stability and financial shape. I just learned yesterday that the Mercy Hospital is struggling, and I'm setting up a meeting with the Hospital Association and leadership of Mercy Hospital so that I can understand better what their concerns are. We're working with JBH, Jefferson Behavioral Health, to understand what their financing is like. We'll look at our indigent acute funding for those kinds of things. That's just an example of the kind of issues that we need to do. We need to have a healthy general hospital acute care system if the state hospital master plan is going to work well, too.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Bob, try to set that up on a Friday so I can attend.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I would welcome your involvement with that. I think that would be very opportune.
Because, Madam Chair, we've met with them. Our delegation did, and it is acute. There's no question about that. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, and other members of the committee, I'm also pleased to see that there is interest in the Portland area in expanding some of the acute care psychiatric capacity. We're looking at a certificate of need that's been submitted, and that process will be reviewed by the health licensing teams in Portland. But the Cedar Hill site, which we've talked about, is a possibility now for an organization. They're out of state, they're for profit, and I don't have a bias for or against that. All I know is that I want to make sure that we work closely with them, and that if they do come into the state, that they provide a high quality service. It's also, I think, fairly well known that Kaiser Permanente has been looking at opening some psychiatric beds out at their Sunnyside site. So they're, and I'm also working with Multnomah County and possibly the other two metro counties to look at the possibility of increasing subacute, non-hospital, but subacute care capacity. We visited a program in Vancouver, Washington 2 weeks ago to see a model for how they're doing that. It's very closely connected with the detox program up there. Central City Concern is interested in talking with us about co-locating possibly a subacute site. So there's also some positive things that we're looking at in terms of the statewide acute care capacity, but I am very concerned about what's happening in the Southern Oregon area. We are stepping up our efforts to recruit psychiatrists, both with Oregon Health Sciences University and also through our own state hospital physician recruitment process. We're doing the same thing with psychiatric nurses at Oregon State Hospital. We've had a Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon Community Services work group that's looking in a very detailed way at what their needs are going to be for the front end and extended care services according to the Phase 2 plan. We had a good report on that yesterday. I think they put together a model that we'll look at for analyzing the needs throughout the state. And as the chair noted, we have met several times with the statewide community services work group that's looking at what do we need to have in terms of front end, in other words, crisis services, things like the early assessment support team, jail diversion programs, assertive community treatment, peer supports. What are all of those kinds of things that we need to have in a healthy community system to try to divert people not only from the state hospital, but even when we can do it from the acute care system, because the whole system at this point is overloaded. I think it's largely because we have not, as a state, found a way to invest satisfactorily in front-end prevention and early intervention services. So I think that's a key part of the discussion that we'll continue to have.
And I also think that with the reform, and I know there's going to be a lot of public dollars invested in this, but once we have working conditions in the new facilities, that certainly is going to be more acceptable to nurses. Because when I toured there, I thought, man, I am so glad that we have such dedicated nurses working in those conditions now.
Madam Chair, I completely agree with you, and I think the staff at Oregon State Hospital are heroic in their efforts to keep going in the face of vacancies, in the face of an outdated building, and we know that we're not as richly staffed as most other comparable state hospitals, so I always want to give credit to the staff and the administration at the state hospital for keeping things going, and they need to keep it going for another 3 or 4 years, obviously, and we've got a lot of challenges ahead of us there. But I know that every review that we have from outside people comment on the dedication and commitment of the state hospital staff to trying to do the right thing.
Senator Carter, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what I was bringing up, the whole issue of system of care in terms of community and the state hospital, because you can have people stay committed so long without rewarding them to some degree. And when you are dealing with a particular group of people who are having the kind of challenges that our people in mental health are having, you need people who not only feel good about themselves, but who are experts in their field. And so I don't think that we can continue to not at least be comparable in our pay to our people as other hospitals our state size and expect them to continue to do work well, because you and I both know how systems can be sabotaged. But if we're going to lend dignity to the people that they serve as well as lend dignity to them as they serve, then we have to be able to do that in terms of cost estimates.
I'm sure, Senator Carter, yes. And one of the things that we're preparing now is a 10-year budget projection, so that we can look at all of the different things that we believe we're going to need to do over the next 10 years. And we think that you are going to be very interested in looking at that as legislators, so that you see not only what's in the budget for this biennium, but what can you anticipate in a whole variety of expenditure areas over the next 10 years. So Dr. Goldberg and our financial staff and Madeline Olson in my office and others are hard at work laying that spreadsheet out and trying to get as good a picture as we can, so that we can help you look at what the future financial decisions are going to need to be.
Great. Thank you.
I think I've covered most of the things that I intended to talk about, and I would just be happy to answer any other questions that you have.
Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Nickel, for your work in mental health and coming here to testify. Can I ask, what is the condition of the 50s building?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, the condition of the 50 building, as you and I saw when we walked through there, is I think in good shape from the structure of the program, and the cleanliness of the program and the maintenance of it is always a challenge. It's the newest building, as you know, that we have. As I've been in there over the years, it continues to look good, but it's architecturally outdated. It's not a good place to provide the kind of treatment model and the kind of settings that we would like to have in order to really do state-of-the-art treatment. I'm not sure if that gets at what your question is about, but structurally, it's got integrity to last for the next period of time. Mm-hmm. Maynard Hammer is here and could probably tell you much more in detail about the challenges of keeping a building of 50 to 55 years old going. I mean, being a little older than that myself, I know the challenges of keeping myself going. So I know that there are issues there.
So it meets code?
Yes.
What's the occupancy situation in that building?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I do want to say that if we were to have to meet all of the current codes and not be grandfathered in, mm-hmm. I think we would have problems there. But as you know, once
well, then that's what I that's what I'd like to know. So it doesn't meet current codes.
If we were to be evaluated against current codes, I think there would be problems there. And again, Maynard Hammer could give you more detail on that, and we can get more detail.
And the occupancy rate, please.
The occupancy is. Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, we are over our funded capacity by just a few beds today. 2 years ago at this time, we were 70 patients over our funded capacity, so we have come a long ways in terms of bringing the census down so that it's within the range that we're funded for and within our occupancy. We're licensed. We never exceeded, although we came very close to exceeding our licensed capacity when we were that's the 70 over. But we are under that now. That's not a problem immediately that we're dealing with. But are the wards overcrowded? Yes, they are. Are they too big? Yes, they are too big, according to all of the modern architectural standards that we...
Can I continue to ask questions?
Yes, please.
Oh, thank you. The issue about the funding of this, now, and this is, for some reason, it's not explained this way. For example, to build the new... the facility that will replace the J building, that facility, not the other facility in the south or the two 16 beds, is somewhere in the neighborhood, is it not, of $320 to $330 million?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, my recollection is that was the cost of building the 360-bed hospital and the 620-bed hospital. And those are estimates based on current construction costs.
All right, but let's just take that. So, but the issue, it isn't like we'd go out and write a check for that amount. They would be bonded. So we are talking bonded indebtedness for this biennium to a certain amount, which is a substantial discussion that should take place in these public forums, because otherwise the magnitude of what we're doing would be prohibited. And I just really wish that would be done. For example, the only figure I have seen for at least by a co-chair's amount for this biennium is $7 million of bonded indebtedness to pay off the bonded indebtedness to deal with the construction of the 620-bed facility that we want to build to replace the J building. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, that's the number that I remember is about $7 million for right. debt service to get the process started. I will go back and double-check my memory. I think it's to get the process started
that's
for
right.
both the 360-bed and the 620-bed.
But that's important to note because... that's just construction. Otherwise, when you get into the community mental health systems and all those costs, it gets prohibitive, and we'll get into a prioritization issue, which will get us right back to where we are. So bondedness is going to play a role in this reconstruction or remodeling or redoing of our mental health system. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, that is correct.
Yes.
We do not, in other words, we do not need to put out $340 million of state general fund this biennium to get this process started.
All right. Isn't it true that you want to open the J building replacement, in 2011? That is the date that has constantly been talked about since 2004. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, if everything moves along according to the schedule that we've been talking about, yes, we could get all of the patients out of the J building by about 2011 if we start moving on it now.
Right. And that does not talk about the 360-bed facility or the two 216-bed facilities. We're not talking about those when we talk about 2011.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, My recollection is that we've been talking about these to date as both units moving forward. Now, that's part of the discussion that I know that we'll begin to get into as we go further with this discussion, whether to build one first and another one 4 years later or 2 years later or 10 years later. I mean, I think that's all part of what the discussion is going to be about.
Except that I do thought the 2011 for sure talked about the replacement of the J building.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, that is correct.
All right. I lost this summer in this discussion to, among other people, the chair on this, which is fine. But I'm curious to know, how many of the six sites, in Salem, Portland, how many of those sites are owned by the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I believe, but I'll get the actual information for you, that three are state-owned and three are privately owned. The three in the Salem area, I believe, are all state-owned.
And the other three in Hillsborough are privately owned?
That's my own.
And of the 10 sites, even though you made a reference to them, how many of those 10 sites in the South are state-owned versus privately owned?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I will get that information for you. I believe about three or four in the Southern Oregon area are state-owned or publicly owned, and the balance are privately owned. Okay.
The last question is, again, the reference to the Department of Corrections, a certain number of the beds of the 620, for example, are going to be just for Department of Corrections inmates. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, by the time both facilities were built out over the next 10 years, we anticipated that 40 or two 20-bed units, 40 patients would be DOC corrections.
It's my understanding, though, that the 20... All right, 40 beds spread out over both facilities or 40 beds in one? It's honest that I thought there was 20 in the J building replacement, or is it 40?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, we haven't really finalized that. I think the sentiment that I've heard from the experts in this area are to probably have those both at the same site.
40 per site?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, it would be probably best to have the most secure, intensive treatment facilities units in one, but not in both buildings.
Okay, I think that's counter to what was said this summer, that you're going to put them both, but that's okay. I have always questioned, that I thought it was 20. I've always been concerned with the number of beds in the J building replacement as being too few. We've discussed this before. I just hope we got a good handle on that, because we know we have a mental health issue in the Department of Corrections, as you know. And once we thought about building a facility which could combine them, you can't do that. You know, I'm talking about the certified smarts. So that bed thing, I guess you'll know what you're doing, but we did have some concerns about the number of beds that were being built. And I thought, a question I specifically asked, I thought they were all going in one facility, and then I was told, no, they wanted them in both the facilities, that is, the both being the 620-bed facility and the 360-bed facility. So not that we can resolve it here. I am just following up a bit on that kind of discussion.
And, Sir Senator Courtney, I do think that we need to continue to follow that up. And at some point, we will be making that decision. Do we have all of the DOC wards in one facility, or do we scatter them between the two?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Just one follow-up.
Yes.
Senator Carter, that would be cost prohibitive to build this kind of secured systems in two different locations. It just appears to me, because you have to have specialty care and security.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'm not sure that the issue is as much architectural and cost of the building, because they're all going to be secure facilities.
Okay.
And I think that the key issue may be the ability to hire the kind of specialized forensic staff in two different locations.
Yeah.
I think that's a piece that I'm wanting to assure myself that we could do if we end up having them in two sites.
Great.
One more.
Yes.
You made a statement that on an ongoing basis you have 12 to 16 psychiatrists, hiring physicians always available, and you're trying to recruit for. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, that is correct.
And there was discussion about locating these facilities as to how certain people, these types of people, will not live in these areas. Do you think that's an issue, really, either in the Salem, Portland area situation or in the Eugene-Aston situation?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, and this is just my opinion, I think that we would be able to recruit staff psychiatrists in the Southern Oregon area, Eugene, or Salem-Portland. I think that the issues with physician recruitment goes toward things like working conditions, salary, benefits, their ability to have an affiliation potentially with a teaching hospital. I think it's really those kinds of things that we're going to have to look at. And I also want to just put on the record, too, that as you may be aware, the state of California has a massive infusion of money going into their mental health system now as a result of a proposition that passed. And we are in competition with the state of California and the state of Washington to hire professional staff, not just physicians, but also nurses and all of the other things. And I've talked quite a bit with my counterpart in California, Dr. Steve Mayberg, who's the mental health commissioner there. And he has major concerns about his ability to recruit in California. So I think this is an issue we're going to have to take very seriously in this state.
And I think at one of our previous meetings, we had asked to get a number of, I think we would get this from the Board of Nursing, the number of psychiatric nurses and the nurse specialists with a psychiatric training, so that we know where they are located and how many we actually have. Because now it's best to get that base now, because if we're truly going to move forward with advertising and working with the schools of nursing and increasing our number of nurses with a psychiatric bent, I think it will be important to have that base number now and see how we are doing in increasing that number. And that should go the same with psychiatrists, but there's so few it's easy to track that.
Madam Chair, we did get that data, and I can go back to the office and find it. I know this, that whatever the number is and wherever they're located, they're not enough.
Yes, exactly. All right.
Yeah,
Senator Cruz.
You brought a very good point, and quite simply, I mean, we have a time frame to work in here, because if we do our work appropriately and we begin the process, and so we have sites up and running by 2011, that's the time frame we have to get the workforce necessary, and it's going to take a focus for us to be able to do that, and because it does not exist currently in the state. So that gets into the whole higher ed budgeting and community college budgeting, and I think if we aren't paying specific attention to that right now, we can have buildings with nobody in them.
Madam Chair, question to you. So are we continuing our efforts at the School of Nursing and other places in terms of scholarships?
Yes, and I think there's a number of bills out there, too, that are working on that. But, again, we need more money in the system. That's the only issue. All right. If there are no further questions, thank you, Mr. Nickel, and I will close the informational meeting and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 32, and I'd like to invite Maynard Hammer, Deputy Superintendent, to please come forward. Before we start, I just want to give a little background here. In February of 2004, Senator Courtney, Senate President Peter Courtney created it's called the Oregon State Hospital Memorial Work Group, and this committee was to recommend to the Department of Human Services a course of action for the cremated remains of deceased patients who died between 1880 and the mid-1970s. And these sealed canisters are currently stored at the Oregon State Hospital. And as you know, it got nationwide media attention. This committee actually met 5 or 6 times without a budget and with only volunteer labor. And I really want to thank Tanya Gross from President Courtney's office, who really took this project on and did an outstanding job in coordinating, convening meetings, and communicating with everyone. She did a superb job, so thank you, Tanya, if you're out there in media land there. The Department of Human Services publicized the existence of the remains to encourage families to claim their relatives' lives. And in 2005, 36 families actually reclaimed the remains of the family members. But there are still, I think, and I think Mr. Hammer will let us know, there are still, I think, over 3,600 unclaimed residents. So as a result, though, of the committee's work, a memorial fund was created within the Oregon Department of Human Services to receive private donations. We helped support an Oregon State Hospital Foundation fundraiser in November of 2005 in Salem. We received input from the state, including generous offers of cemetery space, private land, and other help towards interring the remains. We extended invitations to relevant groups to join our effort, and we did research similar situations in British Columbia, Washington, Ohio, and other states as guidance. And with that, I'd like, is it Dr. Hammer? No, Mr. Hammer, to bring us up to date on where we are, because I do want a work session this Senate Bill 32.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Maynard Hammer, Deputy Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital, which is a part of Addictions and Mental Health Division in the Department of Human Services. It's a pleasure to be here to testify on this bill. I am testifying in support of the bill. We believe it will.
And before I forgot, I would like the administrative assistants to describe Senate Bill 32.
Senate Bill 32 requires the Department of Human Services to disclose certain information to the public regarding the cremated remains in its possession. It declares an emergency, and it takes effect upon passage. Okay. Continue.
We do have about 3,600 unclaimed canisters of remains at Oregon State Hospital. I'll give you a brief background. Some members of this committee were present in October when we dealt with the legislative concept, and then I will talk a little bit about what we have done to try to protect those cremains and what Senate Bill 32 actually does. I have a document prepared by written by a member of the Genealogical Society in Oregon that has the text of Senate Bill 109, which was filed in the office of the Secretary of State on February 25, 1913, directed Oregon State, Oregon State Hospital had changed its name from the asylum to Oregon State Hospital. It directed Oregon State Hospital to construct a crematorium, directed Oregon State Hospital to be the central cremator for all state institutions, including charitable, any mental health, anything, corrections. And it also directed that the 1,500 folks buried at the asylum cemetery be disinterred and delivered to the crematory for cremation. And it further directed that if a person died in any institution, that immediate notification would be made of the family member, and if no claim was made within 3 days or so, that the remains would be delivered to Oregon State Hospital for cremation. That's the origin of where we got to. So from 1913, we had the crematorium, and we used that up until 1971. And we believe that all the disinterments did in fact happen. There is a large block of records. We cannot find either the canisters nor the medical records from the 1,500 persons who were buried at the asylum cemetery. This document also indicates that the asylum cemetery was across from the J Building, across what is now Center Street, what was then Asylum Avenue, and the disinterment was ordered by the Legislative Assembly in order to make room for state buildings, which I assume was an expansion of Oregon State Hospital. So we've had the cremains. They ended up in a mausoleum on the site of Oregon State Hospital until the year 2000. And the water table, when they were examined, the water table had come up around the cremains and was threatening the entire mausoleum, they were moved and ended up in a building which actually houses our old crematory. And that's where they are now. There are about 3,600. Every time there's some publicity, we unite more folks with family members. We believe that the current state and place are not really the final disposition, and we have really looked to the guidance of the chair and President Courtney for and the memorial work group to help determine what the final disposition of these cremains should be. The master plan does make mention that a hospital ought to acknowledge in one way or another a memorial for these patients, although there's no real planning been done yet for that. The cremains that we are in copper canisters sealed with old tin lead type solder, and they're really actually in very poor shape. And let me, if I may, you can take a quick look at what they were like. What we have done since these pictures were taken is create a cremains protection project. We don't have a lot of good facilities. We don't have any real good storage sites on the campus anymore. Most of the buildings where they're used for storage are not airtight and they tend to leak. But we moved the cremains into a room adjacent to where they were, and we have we got a lot of help from the Funeral Directors Association, who told us about how cremains were stored in various types of urns that could be used. What we did was build custom shells. What you see in those pictures, they were stored on basic shells that were not designed for them, three deep. They overhung the shells some. We put the canisters, we ordered black boxes, and I have one if committee would like to see it. There's a bag in the black box. It's a basic industry unit for basic cremains storage. But we put the canister in the bag, in the box, built shelves for them, secured the shelves so the box is secure on the shelf. And they're only one deep now, and they're at least protected for the time being. So they're not in as much danger as they were. And we also have restricted access. We don't take them out and expose them to air or handling for anyone to visualize. So the pictures that you've seen so far in the press and there are likely the last pictures of that sort you will see. I don't have after pictures, but it's just row on row of black box. Senate Bill 32 will help us by directing the Department of Human Services to provide information to family members, and if we have to provide information for the purposes of a memorial, to do so directly without putting an undue burden of proof on the public. And at what we've been previously advised, even though some other states have done it, but we follow the law pretty carefully in Oregon, is publishing names without consent, even for a good public purpose, we're advised is a violation of the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA. Senate Bill 32 would preempt HIPAA, and the preemption is based on there is an exemption in HIPAA for requirements of law. Senate Bill 32 says the department shall disclose, which is pretty direct, and what it said before is may disclose, which is not a mandate, so it wasn't a requirement, and that's how it preempts HIPAA. The other issue is under state law, ORS 179-505, which in many cases preempted HIPAA anyway, because HIPAA has kind of a reverse kind of preemption, where if state law is more restrictive in terms of disclosing private information than HIPAA is, and state law preempts it. So our existing state law basically says for patients, we can't disclose almost anything without consent except for actual treatment kinds of issues. It's very difficult, or unless we're under a court order. And so, consequently, when a family member reads something in the press or they find something in a record and call us and want to know if a relative might be at the hospital, we can't identify or confirm whether the person is there or not. We have to put an undue burden of proof on, in most cases, on family members to determine whether they in fact have a right to know and whether there's anything else in the record that would prevent us from disclosing. And often that would have meant a court order, a lot of back and forth between our staff and family members. And in actuality, the public purpose here is these cremains should be at rest with their families, and not, I don't think it was ever any intent either by state law or HIPAA to get in the way of this sort of thing, but neither law spoke to or had an exemption for trying to reunite cremains with family members. And HIPAA expressly says that a person does not lose privacy rights simply because he or she dies. So that was the box we were in. Senate Bill 32 will allow us to take a call from a family member, exercise due diligence to determine that it is a family member, and then answer directly without causing a lot of back and forth. It would also allow us to publish the names of patients if we needed to publish to create a memorial. That will reduce a lot of effort on our staff trying to work back and forth with family members, some of whom become upset. But even if they don't become upset, it's when you're trying to locate a relative, it's probably a lot of unnecessary back and forth with our staff there. So that's why we are in support of Senate Bill 32. We believe it would be helpful, and we were advised by our Attorney General that it would in fact allow us to exercise these kinds of actions without regard to HIPAA or state law. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Do you have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Carter.
I feel very comfortable because those of us who have been on this committee have gone over this, and mm-hmm. So with that in mind, what I'd like to do is to enter into work session on Senate Bill 32.
Okay. Just one comment before I close the public hearing and open a work session. In the case that there are families who will be very upset because they don't want anyone to know, let's put it that way, with the bill passing like this, there's no way we could be sued for disclosure.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not an attorney. Here's the way, and I'd be glad to get an answer for that. It probably would take attorney advice. HIPAA is a civil rights law. This actually preempts state law, so it's a requirement of state law. So, I don't know what the lawsuit would be under state law, because this takes the place of direction in ORS 179505. HIPAA as a federal civil rights act really doesn't have a cause of action. Now, that's not to say that attorneys cannot find ways to sue, but there's no direct litigation avenue just to say you violated HIPAA. It's a privacy violation, and probably would start administratively with a privacy claim through the Office for Civil Rights, who enforces HIPAA. That's what I'm told, and I've heard the issue about the right of action right from Bennett Prowse, who came on the circuit when I was working on some of the committees at DHS on HIPAA implementation, and he said there is no right of private action in HIPAA, and that you'd go the route of filing a claim with the Office for Civil Rights. Now, that having been said, there are probably as many ways to institute litigation as there are legal theories, so I really could not say that we would not be sued.
I just wanted to have that on the record, because all of these people who had died, it's more than 50 years ago, right? You said 2001 or
71.
1971 was the last. So that means the names of any person who was maybe deceased more than 50 years may be public information. I'd heard that somewhere. But HIPAA would override that.
But may I have Johnny Dutran, our medical records director? She may be able to answer this technically.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joni Dutran, and I'm the medical records manager at Oregon State Hospital. Madam Chair, in order to answer your questions, I believe through the memorial work group process, one of the things that we recognized that as a hospital, we weren't able to release any information regarding our patients. However, we do know that death certificates are a matter of public record after 50 years.
Okay.
And so that information is available via that avenue and not through the hospital.
Okay. That I knew I'd heard the 50 years, and I couldn't remember what. Okay, the certificate. Yes.
Is the 50 years 71 or 77?
So I thought you said 1971.
Yeah, let me double check my timeline here.
I don't need to be picky.
I know, but if there's one.
I know it was in the 70s, the last remains.
1970s, last cremation of record occurred. Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I'd have to check the exact date, so I don't have the exact date.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. If there are no further questions, come in. All right. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 32, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 32. Senator Carter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move Senate Bill 32 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves that Senate Bill 32 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, just want to thank the Chair and Senator Courtney for doing this. This is one of those little things that is very good work, and actually President Courtney is very good at finding these little things and fixing them, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Can I just make one
other Yes, thing? Senator Carter.
Sorry. The President will be very embarrassed by this, but on Monday, the Scanner newspaper recognized him for his work, because I've been here 22 years, and I have never seen the legislature take on this kind of action. That's why I was glad to see Maynard, because I'm not the only one been here for eons of years. But Senator Cruz, you're right. We can't really thank people enough who look into the dignity of man issues, especially when it comes to this kind of an issue. So he was applauded in Portland by the Scanner newspaper for his work on this particular issue.
Thank you, both of you. I agree. All right. Those of the opinion that Senate Bill 32 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gorman?
Excused.
Senator Chair Mons Anderson?
Aye. All right. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And Senator Courtney, do you want to carry the bill?
No, Madam Chair, I defer to you and to other members of the committee to carry.
I'll go ahead and carry the bill then. All right. With that, no further on the agenda. The meeting is adjourned.
It's the first time I've been on the committee. We did something very first day.